Welcome back for the second installment of this two-part series about the landscape of psychiatric medications. Dr. Solomon, a psychiatric resident, Emma, a psych nurse, and I will discuss antipsychotics, mood stabilizers, and ye olde question of when to ask for an expert consult. By the end of this episode, you should feel better equipped when providing care to patients with schizophrenia, acute agitation, and bipolar disorder. This has been a discussion geared towards hospital nurses who don't work on a psych floor, but who will inevitably find themselves in the position of managing psychiatric conditions on the floor, ICU, or emergency department. If this sounds helpful to you, keep on listening. Welcome to the Up My Nursing Game podcast. My name is Annie. I've been a clinical nurse for 8 years, and I am curious. I use this podcast to address common clinical questions, share unique perspectives across the healthcare team, and cover what's missed in nursing school. Part one of this series about psychiatric medications covered antidepressants and stimulants. It was a really great discussion, and I highly recommend listening to it. It's episode number 48. However, for the second part of this series, Dr. Solomon will start out by giving an overview of antipsychotics.
So antipsychotics usually are thought of as two big categories. The first generation, you will think of this as haloperidol and chlorpromazine or thorazine, and they are usually were associated with EPS, the extrapyramidal side effects, which is the muscle twitching and muscle stiffness, and that was a main limitation for using them. Having said that, they are very effective in treating the positive symptoms of schizophrenia. And when we say positive symptoms, I mean the hallucinations and severe delusion. Unfortunately, they worsen the negative symptoms, which is the flat affect that you see on schizophrenic patients or psychotic patients where you think, oh, it's depression, but it's actually not depression. So when you ask them, are you depressed? They say no. It's just some of the negative symptoms. And they can also have some negative effects on cognitive function. But overall, especially in agitation, they are very effective. And in people who are formally diagnosed with schizophrenia, they are still effective. Now, the second generation antipsychotics, which started with risperidone, I believe it was approved 1992 or 1994. They do not only target dopamine, but also the serotonin system. And in that sense, they help with positive, but also negative symptoms. So they can make the negative symptoms less prominent. The side effects are mostly metabolic disorders. Unfortunately, they are associated with high risk of diabetes, high cholesterol, high blood pressure. That's why we have to monitor cholesterol and hemoglobin A1C. They still can cause extrapyramidal side effects, but just less.
For the EPS side effects associated with these medications, is that something that is permanent or will go away as the medication is being metabolized?
I wouldn't say it goes away. I would say if you start to get the EPS, one of the things that you will see on the medical floor is Cogentin with it, right? Have you seen this combination? They are on haloperidol and Cogentin. And the idea is you have a balance of the dopamine system, but also with the acetylcholine system. And when one is really hit down, like say with antipsychotic, then you can get some of the extrapyramidal side effects. I want to say it in a simpler way, these movement disorders. But Cogentin helped by also hitting this acetylcholine system. And people do not have to be on Cogentin forever. No, it's just a period. And then they stop, and then you will see the motor effects are less. Having said that, very long-term use of first-generation antipsychotics is high risk for tardive dyskinesia. And especially, that might surprise you, women in their 40s. And I have no idea why, but the studies see this association. So this is why people now are moving toward, more and more towards the second generation antipsychotic to avoid that. Because it's very discomforting, and it can lead people to stop taking their antipsychotics. You can put certain things like, that was mentioned, Cogentin, and it helps. I have seen it's really helping. It's just the mistake sometimes is we forget to stop it.
The Cogentin.
You don't need to be on Cogentin, for forever. Because remember, Cogentin has high, what we call cholinergic burden. It can, it can affect the memory, can cause confusion if it is cumulative, especially if someone is getting older. So starting something doesn't mean someone has to be on it forever.
As this episode is being released, it is T-minus 56 days until NTI 2023 in Philadelphia. NTI is the American Association of Critical Care Nurses premier conference for progressive and critical care nurses. Guys, NTI is like the Lollapalooza, the Disneyland of nursing conferences. I went to NTI last year, to brush up on my evidence-based practice, which I did, and it was amazing. But what surprised me the most about attending NTI was how being surrounded by like-minded nurses and acknowledging our collective post-COVID trauma was exactly what I needed to fill my nursing cup. This year, I'm excited to go to sessions that will cover topics from ECMO to point-of-care ultrasound, fluid balance optimization to the hazards of suctioning. I'm excited to explore the expo hall and check out the latest and greatest critical care technology. And ultimately, guys, I'm just excited to connect with others and to refill my nursing cup again. Learn more about NTI 2023 by going to aacn.org, which is also in the show notes. And definitely let me know if you're going. I would love to connect with my podcast audience. I hope to see you in Philly. I honestly hadn't really put Haldol and Cogentin together before now. So Haldol, like all first-generation antipsychotics, have those extrapyramidal effects such as Parkinsonianism, dystonia, and akathisia. So Cogentin, otherwise called benztropine, is an anticholinergic medication that can be used to treat these very movement disorders associated with Haldol use. By blocking the action of acetylcholine, Cogentin can help reduce some of the extrapyramidal symptoms. Therefore, Haldol and Cogentin are often given together to manage the side effects of Haldol treatment. The combination of these medications can help reduce the risk of movement disorders and improve the overall effectiveness of Haldol in the treatment of psychosis. Thinking about EPS and other undesirable side effects, I remember back in nursing school, I did a clinical rotation at an inpatient psychiatric ward. My clinical instructor pointed out to me that almost all of the patients were overweight due to the medications that they were on. So between EPS with the first generation antipsychotics and the metabolic disorders associated with the second generation antipsychotics, it's no wonder that medication adherence can be problematic. Luckily, there have been pharmacologic advances that address this very problem. Dr. Solomon explains.
This is one of the very few illnesses across all medical diagnoses, not only psychiatric diagnoses, where we have long-acting injections. So a month or 3 months or 6 months. 6 months is very recent. The reason is, as you might expect, most people don't like psych medications. Sometimes that's because they don't think they need it. Sometimes because of the side effects. I would say the former is the main reason. They don't want to be on it. And so having one injection a month is very helpful versus like a pill every day. The two most common ones that you will see are paliperidone, LAI, or Invega. Paliperidone is basically a byproduct or a metabolic product of risperidone. So we have LAI of paliperidone, and we have the other one is the aripiprazole, and it's Abilify. There is Zyprexa, long-acting injection, but because of the sedation and some impact on autonomic system, they need to be taken specific, clinically approved Zyprexa LAIs, and so we don't. It's very inconvenient at the moment. Might change with time. The two that you will see a lot are Invega and Abilify.
I hadn't heard about these long-acting injections or LAIs before, but it seems really, really cool. So anyone who takes a daily medication knows that it can be tough to stick to a schedule. Now, imagine how many more times difficult that is for someone with schizophrenia. They might not think that they're sick, or they might hear voices in their heads that tell them to not take the medication. So I can see the huge benefits of these LAIs for this specific patient population. In this discussion of daily tablet versus monthly injectables, Dr. Solomon brings up how important the form of medication administration is, especially when it comes to acute agitation.
The one thing to consider in acute agitation in medicine floor, the dosage form. Haloperidol is so commonly used because it's available in every single or most forms that you can imagine. So if the patient doesn't want to take a pill, you have an injection. If there's an IM, there's an IV. There is an LAI too. So the Zyprexa has disintegrating tablets. So if someone's cheeking them in, it would dissolve, so you can check. The same with risperidone. That's why you will see these four or three medications. Haloperidol, Zyprexa, and risperidone are used as first line for agitation, more than even the side effects. Because one dose or two dose, you will not get lots of side effects at that time. It is how I can't someone who is really now causing harm to themselves or harm to others can take this medication. And if something can be greatly, like I'll tell you, Acinipin, I'm not sure what's the brand name. It is, like you see in studies, it is powerful antipsychotic and I assume it will work in agitation. But the fact that you have to put a pill under your tongue for 15 minutes to dissolve and get absorbed, that is not going to happen in an acute setting.
With all this discussion of severe side effects and medication adherence, I started to somewhat naively wonder why Haldol or any first-generation antipsychotics are ordered at all, especially for long-term therapy.
So this is maybe just that I have more acute experience, but I feel like when a patient is basically on Haldol, they're probably the kind of patient who it doesn't really matter the side effect burden, but they need to be on the drug, you know? But with somebody who's on something like Seroquel or even like an SSRI, they might be a patient who the side effect burden really matters. Like it really, in terms of the effect of their illness on their life versus a side effect burden, when you're weighing those two things out, versus something like an antipsychotic.
Yes. I think you're hitting on a very good point here, Emma, is the benefit and risk. It is, at the end, someone who's not only completely dysfunctional in a society, that is also a burden on the caregivers, a burden on everything. And the poor patient doesn't even understand that they have an illness because the organ of disease is the organ of consciousness and of decision-making. So that's the difference between having a fracture in your leg where you still, you can't tell your brain, oh, I don't have a fracture. No, you see it. But if the organ of decision is the one that's affected, there might be no insight into it. And that's the biggest difference, like, between like medical and psychiatric diagnoses. This is one of the main differences, but the insight into the illness can be really limited. In mental illness, and particularly schizophrenia and bipolar, it is hard that the patient would accept this as a diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And especially, like, say, in mania, which we didn't talk about, people get addicted to mania. It is a beautiful feeling based on the patient. They tell you, you are on the top of the world. Why would they give this high to anything? But what then happened is the severe, prolonged depression. And it is not the same as unipolar depression. I want to make this point also clear. The bipolar depression and bipolar depression treatment is not the same as unipolar. Because if we use SSRIs and SNRIs, they can have high risk of flipping into mania.
Talking about bipolar disorder in contrast to just depression, or as is said here, unipolar depression, brings us into the next class of psychiatric medications, mood stabilizers. It's important to note that patients with bipolar disorder are not prescribed SSRIs or SNRIs even when in a depressed state due to the risk of flipping into mania. Instead, mood stabilizers are prescribed.
Lithium is another one. Remeron, another one. And Wellbutrin. But those are the ones that you will see a lot also on the medical floor.
I'll add here that I'm also seeing anticonvulsants such as valproic acid, also called Depakote, and carbamazepine, also called Tegradol. I would be remiss not to mention an important nursing consideration for mood stabilizing medications. So lithium, Depakote, and Tegradol all require therapeutic drug monitoring, which is done with blood draws. Okay, with medications largely covered, Emma brought up the big question.
Dr. Solomon, you had some thoughts about when to not use a psych consult, like what kind of things the medical doctor should be able to do for themselves.
This is one of the, as you know, contentious points always about consult. It's a privilege to get a consult, but sometimes what's considered appropriate versus inappropriate consult, you notice in general, is that whenever it comes to psych, people freeze. It's like the physicians and other specialties, and it's understandable. Why? Because there's an element of law and enforcement. And that's when I mentioned one of the differences between psych and medicine, medication or even treatment, is the organ of disease is also the organ of thinking and the organ of consciousness.
Okay, fair enough. But what if we're dealing with an acutely agitated patient on a medical floor and getting nowhere? Can we request a psych consult then?
If the medical causes have been tested and excluded, if the patient has dementia, I would say on, obviously, delirium on dementia, I think this is where psych can help sometimes. If the patient has Parkinsonism and then there's now delirium, because the medications will be different. So using the second generation antipsychotic can actually make them worse. Agitation that is not caused by a medical issue and it's mostly you're suspecting psych. So that's a good time. But make sure that the medical issues are addressed. Assess the pain. Pain is a big factor for causing delirium. And this can be done by the medical team. Look at the medication list. Anything, if you see high anticholinergic burden, try to clear this. And then you can ask psych for say, help, how can we minimize the number of psychotropic medications? Pain meds can cause delirium. So not only pain, but pain medications. If you're trying to tweak it and you're unable to, you can consult psych for sure. And there are patients that I think the biggest thing for consulting psych, because we tend to focus on delirium capacity, but management of psych illness in inpatient hospital. Like if someone now on lithium and this needs to be stopped because of surgery or something, how to reinitiate this? If you start the medication and you think it might interact with their meds, with their psych meds, good time to consult psych. So really the patients are already coming to you with psych illness. And okay, if the medications are stable, things are fine. Suicidality, absolutely. This is big red flag. And psych can be and should be consulted because this is basically one-way ticket. Like you can't retrieve this patient if they, God forbid, commit suicide. And so this is what makes it more acute. And have your next of kin phone number or name available because you never know when you will need them. Actually, my sign outs to the person who will take after my shift would try to make this clear. And you will be amazed how helpful it is because if things escalate on the medical floor and someone need to, as you said, consent to something, it can, oh yeah, who is the DPOA? Is there a guardian? And it will take time and know from the get-go who is second in line. And that will help psych also consult team know what to do next.
I love it when the doctors write notes about collateral interviews they've done because I feel like I get to know my patients like 100% better just by having that. When they write collateral notes, like on psych patients, you know, it'll be like, oh, well, he says that he, you know, does this kind of drugs and actually he does this some other array of drugs. And it's like night and day. Mm-hmm. And because your empathy is such a high value to you on the psych floor as a nurse, you want to believe them, you know, and you get such good information from them sometimes. And then other times it's
completely
like
completely different story,
completely the opposite of what is the story, you know, and then do you trust the person that's giving you collateral information or not?
You don't believe them just because they happen to not be a psych patient, you know,
But sometimes there is a stigma. I mean, with addiction, there is a big stigma. So people will not tell you sometimes what they are on. And not everything is detected in urine, including mushroom. We don't have testing for mushroom. Or maybe we will do. I don't know. One thing, I'm glad that you mentioned this point, getting the collateral early. Because in medical floor, sometimes you think, oh, he has a daughter. Let me contact the daughter right now. And the relationship might be so severe that the daughter doesn't even know that this patient is in the hospital. So if you ask them early on, who can we contact? In case we need, like we need decision making, who will be the surrogate decision making? That will save you headache as a nurse if they got delirious. Because sometimes they choose a friend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you can document this and patients at death are legally okay, even if they have kids. So the legality can be really tricky here if you don't know ahead of time.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Knowing the baseline is essential for diagnosis because some people are hyperthymic by nature. And you might think they are manic, but they're not. Mm-hmm. Or they're circumferential or tangential in the way they talk. This is their baseline. And they're still okay. But mm-hmm. what and how much of the change and the duration of the change you can only know from people who know them or lived with them or talk to them on a daily basis, and then you can make some informed decisions.
I give a lot of props to all the psychiatrists out there who are wading through patient and collateral interviews to piece together a diagnosis, as opposed to physicians who have the luxury of simply viewing radiology reports and lab values to diagnose medical conditions. But one common thread that I'm hearing from both medical and psychiatric sides is how important knowing the patient's baseline is. Both rapid responses I've had on the podcast have harped on this. And so did Dr. Matuszak in one of the earlier episodes about inpatient hypertension. And now, Dr. Solomon stresses the importance of understanding a patient's baseline mood. So that wraps up this series about the landscape of psychiatric medications. I hope that this has better prepared you for managing psychiatric conditions wherever you work in the hospital. I hope that this podcast has helped you improve your nursing practice. If you found value in this podcast, please share it with your fellow nursing friends and colleagues. It really helps me to grow the show and to keep producing these high-value episodes for you. If you would like more practice-improving content in between episodes, follow me on Instagram or Facebook at UpMyNursingGame. Keep sharing this podcast with your nursing friends and colleagues. It would really mean the world to me. Claim your free CE credit, and until next time, I hope that you have upped your nursing game.